Shocking the allegation, Kuhn fled from the scene of the accident, stepping over his injured son.
That's today's top stories from AM 1290's News Center, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duver and I are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Coda Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Are we still going to be able to use the word small independent? I mean, aren't you taking
with
over
with
the
market growing, it is growing, yes,
okay, it is
which
growing.
which is good. Good news. And we have with us today John Greathouse. John, thanks for being here with us.
Of course. You're brave to have me live. It's kind of frightening. And in front of a studio audience, too.
Exactly.
Do the applause sign.
So the first article we have today is from the Wall Street Journal, and it is an article whose subject is very much like some of the articles we've had over the last few months, which is about chasing yield or trying to get a higher investment income out of desperation. And what makes this article interesting to me is that there are now some statistics that they've made available to show how much this has impacted the risk involved in chasing yield. And the Bank of America recently did a study that showed that junk bonds had their yield shrink by 342 basis points since the end of 2015, whereas in the equivalent yield on a 10-year Treasury bill has only declined by 0.06 basis points. So there's been a tremendous narrowing in the what I would call the risk premium to buy junk. And what this article does is it asks some questions. Why are people willing to do this? And so in another study, this one by Natixis Global Asset Management.
Natixis?
You say Natixis, I say Natixis.
Just helping you out.
Okay, thank you. These are very difficult terms to get to grasp.
These are.
I understand the whole issue with
it's like spreads. A language class.
It's
for
like
you.
A language. Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, you're from Boston, so you're showing off. So they asked a bunch of investors what they quote unquote need for return, and majority said they needed an 8.9% return after inflation to reach their financial goals.
Which in bonds is just not even in the ballpark.
Well, since 1926, the return on U.S. stocks after inflation averaged 7%.
Right. So stocks
is stocks didn't even do it. And so one of the interesting things is to show you, and this is, I guess, is an example of how extreme it's gotten. There's a new company that just filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission on September 26th. And here's the deal. They are investing in first of all, they're going to guarantee cash distributions, regular cash distributions, they are going to buy properties that serve college students and elderly, okay? So they've raised all this money. Number one, they are not in business yet. They have no properties. They have no discernible experience, and this thing was sold out. So it's because they say in the prospectus, we're going to make regular cash distributions. So it just shows you how people are willing to create a solution to their 8.9% yield in a 7% environment by doing things that are really kind of
right.
Silly.
Well, you know, we're in an environment now where a $100,000 CD gets you annually, which means you roll it once. You know, you're getting $338 or something insane like that. You're not even keeping up with inflation. And it's a real problem because people have become risk adverse, and therefore they think, you know, bonds are the place to go, but then they're taking on all this excess risk without getting any return for it.
What I suggest people do is, you know, I bought a new mattress last week and the mattress was pretty expensive, and I think it would have been better if I put money in underneath the old mattress. Because it would have cost me less.
You know, right now there's $12.4 trillion in cash in our institution, in our system, not counting the mattress.
This is not all in Arlington.
No. In the U.S. economy, okay. In banks primarily, there is $12.4 trillion in cash.
Wow.
It's a huge amount of cash that's making virtually nothing.
So the next article is about a subject that everyone's been talking about since the election or before the election, which is the fact that wages have not kept up with expectations.
And especially now when you have the unemployment rate below full employment, so we're at 4.3%, there still has been the beginning signs of wage pressure, but not much.
Exactly. And so the way the article begins, this was in the New York Times on Saturday, it looks at since 1972, non-supervisory and production employees, which is 80% of the American workforce, brought home an average wage equivalent to $738 after, in today's dollars, after adjusting for inflation. And last year, it was $723. So basically, 44 years have passed with the typical American worker absorbing a 2% pay cut. And so the article, which is a very lengthy article, is talking about some of the reasons why. And again, there's all kinds of views, and there's a lot of political noise in depending upon what your political view is as to what the reason is. But what this article did, which is a little bit different, is they looked at a whole host of countries. They just didn't look at America.
Well, and the author, I believe, of most of the studies is from Norway.
Yes. And this was in Norwegian, which was very difficult for me to read. So I couldn't pronounce
it. Another linguistics.
Another linguistic
point of reference.
Yeah. So so here's this article that talks about worldwide. This is a worldwide problem. And to keep people from suspense, what he found is that besides being a new economic order, that is, expectations are, people have very little leverage to get a good deal from their bosses. And one of the reasons is that in the last 25 years, the number of people in a union versus what they were is down 50%. So whatever you think of unions, the empirical evidence would suggest that they are a factor in keeping wages up. The second thing they found was that companies are so nervous about the economy, even after this recovery since 2008, that they're taking advantage of the new paradigm, which is hiring people from temporary agencies, partly because of wage savings, but also partly because they don't want to take on a full-time employee when they're not really satisfied.
Well, you know, and especially when you look at the cost of health care that continues to jump up 17% year over year, you know, it's a big expense to take on a new employee and provide them with benefits.
And what was the most surprising thing is that he looked at Norway, which he said is the poster child for having a sense of responsibility to employees, and employees having a sense of responsibility to their co-employees. So historically, if there was ever an economic problem, all the employees would get together and say, don't fire anyone, we'll all take a pay cut. And what they found is there seems to be a breaking up of that safety net. And again, this is a political statement, is because of lower wage workers from countries that are, in his view, from Eastern European countries. And the way it manifests itself is not simply that people immigrate. It's not about immigration. It's about competitive bidding. And the end of the article was sort of like with a explanation point, is that there's a major a tunnel being built in Norway, and it's being built by a foreign company because the foreign company was able to bid so much lower than a Norwegian company. And he says, you know, that's, you know, globalization, where even with labor, globalization, maybe not in America because it's tough to, have someone from Spain to build a plant here, but your Eastern European countries are coming in and creating contractors and are taking business away.
Well, and so, that is one of the major impacts of globalization. The positive side of that is you're getting the same work done for a lower cost. The negative of that is, you know, upward pressure on wages it doesn't help at all.
Yeah, and one of the things that the article doesn't talk about, I have an article here that I was about to talk about, but we're running out of time. So let me just summarize what the essence was, is that the biggest driver to growth for America, certainly, would be if employees made more money, because they'd have more disposable income and therefore more ability to buy things. And instead, you know, the sort of mantra particularly of leveraged buyout companies and companies being forced to look at quarterly earnings, is to cut expenses. So when you cut expenses, you get the benefit of short-term profit margin increase, but you also if you're cutting labor, you're losing the ability for your customers' base to grow. And if elected,
yes,
I promise.
Neil for mayor? Is that what we're running for now?
No. We have enough mayoral candidates.
Sure.
You're listening to You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. And we can be reached at 564-1290.
Or you can also email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. And today we have John Greathouse, who is a serial entrepreneur and a pillar of our community in the tech community here in Santa Barbara with us. Thanks for being here, John.
Well, if I'm a pillar, we're in trouble.
You are. Some earthquake whether you insurance. Like it or not. You are. He's a mentor to many people I know and always provides thoughtful and insightful advice.
Thank you. Well, I try. You know, I think it's one of the ways I can give back, teaching at UCSB and helping people. I did, you know, talk to somebody on the phone this morning that's, you know, in that process of trying to raise money. So it's just something I'm happy to do it. Sometimes it can be overwhelming, everyone that wants to have coffee. So I do
just,
a lot of
Yeah, you just
phone
have
calls.
So much coffee
yeah.
available.
Yeah, or I'll stack them up and have three or four people. I'll just meet them one after the other, like a game show. And,
right.
Yeah. So
like
anyway.
Speed dating.
It is a little. I wish it was a little faster than speed dating, but no, I enjoy it most of the time. It's a great way to get back.
So how did you get to where you are today? You were a serial entrepreneur, and then you started a venture capital fund, which is Rincon Ventures.
Yeah, I didn't start it.
Or, sorry.
Yeah, just to be clear, I don't want
right.
to misconstrue. So Jim Intelman founded the fund in 2005, and I joined about 2007. We ended up with three funds, about $100 million in total, 60 companies or so. I haven't counted them, but around 60 investments. Still very active. I don't know what the active number would be, probably 30-some active companies. Some have exited. Fortunately, very few have gone by the wayside. So we've been very fortunate.
You picked a really good time to go into the speculative investing
business. Yes. You know, it's funny about 07. It was actually a great time to be an investor, even though, you know, it was a hard time to be an entrepreneur. But the valuations were very aggressively low, and we were writing checks. So we were able to get into deals that maybe they would have been out of reach for us. We were a small fund. The first fund was $26 million, I know that sounds like a lot of money. But in the world of venture capital, anything less than $100 million is considered a small fund, and we were at 26.
Right.
So we were really a small fund. But the 07-08 really worked for us because we were writing checks, leading deals. We were willing to just commit to the things we believed in. And that, you know, got us into some decent companies.
And what is your focus area?
So we are pretty narrowly focused. So one of my companies that I was fortunate to be part of it from the beginning was Expert City, which we sold to Citrix. Some of the products people are familiar with are GoToMeeting, GoToMyPC, GoToWebinar, GoToTraining, things like that. And
it's really a cool technology where you can share your computer. I do it with my clients who are long distance.
Yeah, we, you know, it's a great, you know, Klaus Schalzer and team just built really wonderful product. Our set of products. So when I decided to be, I was an angel investor first because I just wanted to see if it was something I would enjoy doing. It's very different from being an operator. And I invested in RightScale, which is a great company here in town, Appfolio, which went public, which was a wonderful, wonderful to see those folks succeed. And then another one called Eucalyptus, which HP Hewlett Packard bought. So in doing those investments, I realized this was something that I would enjoy. I was a little concerned at the beginning that I would want to jump in and not be, you know, this advisor role can be fun for a while, but then, you know, do you get frustrated and want to start?
Right. You get frustrated
things
with the decisions they're making, right, and you want to go in and do it your way.
Yeah, but I didn't. I found that I got a lot of vicarious enjoyment out of working with young entrepreneurs, young and old, but a lot of them are young, younger entrepreneurs, and helping them. And I sort of equate it to, and I didn't come up with this analogy, but some other investor said that it's like being a grandparent. You have all the benefits of the children and playing with them, but then you can leave. Like, so I'll sit in a board meeting, say, this is my opinion, this is what I think. Look, I don't run this business, it's up to you, and then I just leave. And then all the hard work still has to be done by those poor
folks.
That
is a great analogy.
Yeah, I know. I think investors are, not all of them, but a lot of them are kind of lazy. Lazy compared to an entrepreneur. So an entrepreneur is 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. There is no, you just do it, right? You do the work until it's done.
It's like parenting.
Like parenting.
You know, they come to you regardless.
You don't yell from the
not.
Kitchen, shut up, I'm not feeding you, right?
Right.
No, but being an investor is quite different. So you can kind of dip in and dip out and be helpful. And you know, on the way here, I did a phone call with an investor who's trying to close his round. So you can still be helpful, but you're not at it day in, day out.
So now how typical do you think it is that the role that you're a successful entrepreneur gone VC? How most venture capitalists
get started? Now that's very, very true. So if you go back 10 years, I've been doing it for 10 years, I was the exception. So to be an operator turned venture capitalist was not the norm. The norm was you go to an Ivy League school, you become an investment banker, and then you graduate from investment banking to doing venture capital. Sort of that was where a lot of people took. But it's changed. So in 10 years, I'd say that the kind of the hot, cool kid funds that a lot of money is pouring into, it's former operators. It's Twitter, Facebook, Google, not founders, but operators, people that were there early, people that have seen explosive, massive growth. Those folks can get together and raise $50 million really fast because people that invest in venture capital funds have seen the returns of funds run by people that are operators as opposed to bankers tend to be better because we can empathize. We can sit in a board meeting and actually help make pragmatic decisions because we've done it before.
But, you know, if you look at your business from afar, it seems really romantic, but I know
it's not.
But I taught investments for 12 years at City College, and I'd always find at least one kid in each class that would come to me with an idea, and it usually was a horrible idea.
Yep.
And what do you say? And so the question is, if you get 100 unsolicited ideas, what's the percentage that actually get looked at, and what's the percentage that you'd be really interested in doing?
Yeah, that's actually what I am. That is exactly the question I'm asking myself right now. if I want to do another, if I want to continue to do another fund, I've had people approach me, and it's very flattering offers to get involved. But one thing I want to do is address what you just said, which is there a way we can create a venture fund where the funnel at the top is truly open to everyone? It's not open to everyone right now. And it's no secret, right? The way you get and the way you get time with the venture capitalist, a legitimate somebody who's had some success, is you have to get a introduction. And if you read any, I mean, I've written, I've said it, so I'm guilty of this too. If you read any of the bloggers that are well read, they all say the same thing, which is, oh, you want to get money? Find someone in their trusted circle who will make an introduction for you. Well, that's wonderful if you know somebody in the inner circle, or if you're just so incredibly ambitious and wily that you can figure that out. But what about the all these other people, the 100 deals you're talking about, that for whatever reason can't make that intro? They don't get venture capital. Now, they might get other sources of money. In many cases, probably other sources are more appropriate. But I'm always asking myself, like, what is, you know, who are those unknown people that we didn't ever get to see, never surface their idea? To answer your question, I've never looked at a deal that was over the transom. Like, I've never looked at a deal that just came in. It's always been someone who got an introduction. Like today, the person I talked to this morning got an introduction from a trusted friend. That trusted friend reached out to me and said, would you talk to this person? I put money in their company. I think it's for real. And then I talked to them. I don't think it's possible to take all the inbound without some filter. But I think our filter is too tight. And I think it's resulted in a lack of diversity in tech that we need to deal with. You get you just get a lot of concentration of the same sorts of kinds of people that have access to that inner circle, and we need to figure out a way to fix it.
Yeah, I heard a TED Talk recently where a venture capitalist was saying there are 1,000 people who will write a letter, 100 will get past the first screening, we'll look at 15, and we'll invest in 4.
That's about right.
And that kind of odds is, you know, very frustrating, I would imagine, for...
That's about our numbers. ours, we approximate 1,000 deals come our way a year, and we do 2 to 4 deals a year.
Yeah. You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press Radio, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hope you enjoyed your meal. And I just want to say, he's lucky to have a brother like you.
Lucky? Caring for my brother is far from easy. Waking up every day, lifting him from the bed to the wheelchair to the car to get him to therapy on time, it's no small task between the doctors and the diagnosis, but nothing can disable this love. This is my big brother, my hero. He's part of me, like my arms and legs. So I'll be his. See, there's no time for tired. This starts again tomorrow. He'll be waiting for me. I wake up for him. I know he needs me, but I'm the lucky one. Even though I need help now and then.
If you're caring for a loved one, visit aarp.org/caregiving for care guides and community. Or call 877-333-5885. Caregiving Resource Center. Support for your strength. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If you have trouble handling your anger, get help. If someone you love is hurting or scaring you, get help. There is a full-service domestic violence agency in Santa Barbara County, which offers emergency shelter, counseling, transitional housing, anger management, and teen outreach programs. Its name is Domestic Violence Solutions for Santa Barbara County. Call their 24-hour helpline at 964-5245. Domestic Violence Solutions for Santa Barbara County. Putting an end to domestic violence.
Did you know that domestic violence sends more than 500 women and children to emergency shelters every year? There is a place where all family members affected by domestic violence can get help. Domestic Violence Solutions for Santa Barbara County, with 4 24-hour phone lines to help. In Santa Barbara, call 964-5245. In Santa Maria, call 925-2160. In Lompoc, call 736-0965. And in Santa Ynez, call
686-4390. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with John Greathouse, serial entrepreneur and mentor in Santa Barbara.
And
if you don't want to be a pillar, I'll give you a mentor. So let's talk a little bit about the economics of being a venture capitalist mm-hmm. firm, basically. And how is it structured? You know, because a lot of people listening, everyone hears the term, but what does it really mean?
And it's misused a lot, which is fine. People that aren't in this industry, it kind of gets used in a much broader sense than
right.
it really is.
Yeah.
The way it works is it's actually fascinating if you look at the history. So in the olden days, like before World War II, the way somebody would get funding is for an idea or a venture or whatever was you kind of had to know a rich person. You kind of had to know a Rockefeller or an Astor
Ford
or Montgomery, somebody that had money. And what happened is by those third, fourth generation of those families with wealth, first off, the kids just sort of didn't want to do anything, and secondly, they realized they're really bad at picking good companies. So picking your friends, brothers, uncles, is not the right way to do it. So a couple of folks from Harvard and post-World War II got together, and they created really the first venture capital firm. And they just took money from those people that, the Mellons, et cetera, that had money but didn't have the wherewithal or the knowledge, and they pooled it. And then they made investments as a professional investor, just like you do in your line of work. So it's an institutionalized way of investing. So I have investors in my fund. I have limited partners, pension funds, people that manage billions of dollars. They put a very small allocation of their entire portfolio in venture. They'll put like 1-2%, which can be a lot of money when you have billions of dollars. And that's money that they're just hoping to get an outsized return. They're hoping that, they get an Uber or a Google or Facebook or something that's going to really, really move the needle. Because when you're only investing 1-2% of your portfolio, you have to have a really big return or otherwise you're never going to see the impact.
Right, exactly. And so what type of return are you looking for as a VC in a company? You hear like a 10x. You want to make your investment 10 times what it is.
You hear a lot of BS.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, I think that's probably a decent rule of thumb. I think first off, we just look for the right team and that's solving a problem that we think is important and that they're passionate about solving. But getting back to the numbers, so I think we want to know that a company, if it succeeds, could approach $100 million in revenue. It doesn't mean that it will. It doesn't mean that it'll be around as an independent entity that long. It might be bought when it's at $30 million or $50 million. But we want to at least believe that, yeah, we think there's a shot at $100 million total revenue if this company does it right. And we would, we'd love to see a 10%. If we don't, a 10X. If we don't think we can get a 10X return over the life, we might still do the investment. But there would have to be another compelling reason for us to do that.
And as a VC, when you do an investment, do you normally, with that investment, comes a board seat?
Yeah, that's the part that's hard to scale. So, I'm using all this jargon. So that's the part that's, you can only have so many board seats.
Right, exactly. Well, you only have so much time in your
right.
day to be sitting on all these board meetings.
Yes, and doing the calls and helping them with recruiting. So yes, and that's where you have to balance it. We're a very early stage investor, so it's very important for us to be on the board. We tried to do a couple small investments where we didn't sit on the board, and we found that we did the same amount of work. We still ended up doing the same number of calls and recruiting the things that we do. So we kind of pulled back from that, and we decided, no, we're going to write a decent-sized check for our fund. It's still a small check, but a decent-sized check for our fund, and we're going to be involved, and we're going to help the CEO and the founding team as an adjunct executive for the first year to 2 years. Over time, if the company's growing and doing their job, then I become less important because they have smart, skilled people around the table and they don't need somebody like me.
And to be in this business where you advise, not just write checks, isn't there a tendency to have to specialize in one industry?
Absolutely. Yeah, and our fund is – I didn't really answer your question, Diane. You asked me earlier about what we focus on. So think about GoToMeeting, GoToMyPC. Those were work productivity solutions. That people could pretty much pull out a credit card and try and then buy. And they were very horizontal. So what that means is it could be used by many, many different industries. They weren't industry specific. So those are the kinds of companies I look for. Now, not everything in our portfolio fits that exact model. But they're called B2B SaaS, which means business-to-business software as a service. So it's a business that's selling software on a subscription basis to another business. That's a pretty broad umbrella. And there's just so many common problems and issues that those companies face. And so when I sit in a board meeting, chances are I've heard some variant of the problem they're dealing with, and I have some variant of an answer that they can at least consider. But so, you're right. You do need to be focused.
So if somebody comes to you with a great food service business, you'll just say,
I wish him well.
Right. So but there are generalists, aren't there?
Not many left. So if you look at the venture from 10 or around more than 10, 15, 20 years ago, you would have some firms that were, they would do med device, they would do telecom, they would do food. But just, it's really hard to be good in those verticals if you're not, if you don't have specific expertise.
Are there any firms left that don't want to help
I don't want to name any.
But
there's
no,
a lot of them that don't want to help.
Who don't want to? Their thing is to give money and hope for the best. Isn't there a sort of a difference between somebody that really wants to get in and help and someone that's just giving money checks?
Yeah, I've co-invested with those people. Yeah.
Okay. So they still exist.
They do. On that call I had today on the way here, I was like, what about so-and-so? Why didn't he review those docs? I mean, yeah, there's people that are AWOL. They just, what the VC game is to raise another fund. So you raise a fund, you have a little bit of success, you go raise another one. And if you get in this cadence of every year to 2 years, you're raising a new fund, well, who does that benefit? It benefits the venture capitalists because they're getting a 2% fee on every dollar they raise. So they end up with 3, 4, 5 active funds. There's no way they can say they want to help, and they probably do want to help. It's really difficult, impossible to help at that level when you have so many different companies in your portfolio.
So let's go back to how do you go about raising new funds and new partners into your fund?
It's really just like a startup. So the large majority of venture capital first funds never have a second fund. They just don't do well enough. Right? Or the partners don't like each other, or who knows, right? But most of them,
same reasons why any other business fails.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to raise money for a new. I mean, I mentioned the Twitter, Facebook. There are exceptions. There's been a few recent VC funds where they raise money very quickly, but they had incredible track records. For the most part, it's a slog. So the first fund that we raised was mostly people that knew us pretty well. The second fund was a combination of institutional investors, so people that invest for a living, and family offices and people that knew us. And the third fund was easy. I mean, by then, we had a track record. We had portfolio companies. We had exits. People kind of understood how we worked. And it was relatively easy to raise our third fund. And if I had decided to stay and do a fourth one, I assume it would have been relatively easy as well.
So now, when you are looking at companies, when it comes to founders, what do you look for? Like, because I'm assuming that people listening to the show are going to say, oh, well, I need money. I'm going to call
that.
So let's narrow it down for you before they call.
No, don't call me. I'm not actively investing right now. I'm not. So our third fund is out of its investment phase. So I'm still tending to a lot of companies, but we're not writing checks right now. I could just throw out all these cliches. It's really, you're really looking for that one in 1,000 we talked about. We're really looking for an exceptional person. And the only way I can figure out whether somebody's truly exceptional is spend a lot of time with them. And that, again, that doesn't scale. Like, I can't spend a lot of time with all 150 people to hope to find one. So it's just a lot of interactions, and that's why our diligence period is often months. In fact, it's usually months. You know, we want to take our time, and if somebody's in a hurry or they already have a round that's basically pulled together, I just say, we're not your investor, and if I can help you, I will make an introduction or whatever. But I can't rush my process. My process is I have to really know who you are.
Right. Yeah, that isn't scalable given the amount of companies that you have.
Well, that's why we do two investments per partner per year is kind of where we averaged.
A similar thing about making sure you know someone is marriage.
Yes, yes. But you can get divorced, and I'm not divorced. I'm quite happily married. Divorced. She's a wonderful woman. But the difference between divorce, if people use that analogy in investing, but it's different. You really can part amicably with someone in a marriage. If I'm your investor, I'm there for the duration. I'm not just going to – there's no amicable split.
Right. Well, can you get out?
It's hard. I mean, it's very, very rare that somebody could buy you out or something. It would be beyond unusual. You usually get out when the founders get out.
And I have to ask you this, but what percentage or – is there a number that you want to talk about of failures? I mean, is there a failure?
A handful in our fund. But our fund's, I think, different because we're very specific. We understand B2B, SaaS, and so we can see before we put money in the trajectory to success. I mean, we're not putting money in ideas. We're putting money in businesses that have customers, that are repeatable business process, which is very different. A lot of investors will invest in very early stage ideas. And they're going to have they might have a bigger success rate if it's a new drug, but they're going to have a higher fail rate.
So, for your successful portfolio companies that have exited, what do you typically see as a percentage, based upon the exit that you would receive or return? Yeah, that's a better way to word it.
It varies. You know, it really varies. It varies on how much money did we put in, what was the valuation at the time we put it in, what did it sell for. I think if a VC fund does better than 3x over its life, it's okay. You probably could raise another fund. If you start doing 4, 5, and 6x, then you're doing exceptionally well, and you're going to beat returns in your vintage year, no doubt. I don't know what investors say they shoot for, but I think a 3x is really what most people probably would be happy with. Even a 2x isn't horrible, but it's going to vary in your portfolio. You might have one that's a 10x, 12x, 50x, and you have ones that barely make their money back.
And so when you're dealing with the founders, how often, I've got to imagine that people who are entrepreneurs and they need money.
Yep.
You kind of are in this desperate stage almost of wanting
and
the
I
money.
And I hate to see founders in that stage.
Right. And it's kind of this, they need it in order to continue.
Right.
So it's this double-edged sword.
Right.
And you see many founders get diluted, not necessarily from you as a VC, but
I get diluted.
as you raise that next dollar, stay alive,
sure.
Pretty much. How do you see that affecting founders in terms of return? Do you think the VCs end up making a better return off the sale of said company or the founders?
So because that's going to be sector specific. So if you're looking at a med device or something that requires like an Inogen here in Santa Barbara that requires $50, $80, $100 million to go public, then clearly the founders aren't going to have the position that a VC would. But in my business, I've seen founders hold on to decent slugs of their companies. 20%, isn't out of the ordinary. As a group, so maybe there's two or three people that own 20%. Thus, that's changed. In the old days, before we had cloud computing, all these things that we used to have to go buy servers and spend money.
Infrastructure was expensive.
Infrastructure and software even cost money. You know, if a group of founders had 10% at the end of the day, they would be considered well off. So we're seeing 20, 25. I mean, it's creeping in the founders' direction. I think they're getting more of the benefit of these lower costs to get going than the investors are.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
You're bringing your daughter to her favorite pop star's concert. Do you A, wear earplugs?
A soft pretzel.
B, remember the moment with matching concert t-shirts.
That's gonna be $180.
Or we can just take a photo.
C, show her how you used to do concerts.
We're going crowd surfing!
I can't, it's too heavy! Oh my god!
Or D, just roll with it.
Woo! Justin! Look at us, we're over here!
Justin! OMG! I love you, Justin! I love you!
When it comes to parenting, there are no perfect answers. But that's okay, because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Star Jasmine Music serves over 3,600 people per year. By providing a safe, supportive environment to explore music, you'll find a place that resonates within. We teach songwriting and how to play a variety of instruments. We have a Pro Tools state-of-the-art recording facility and provide opportunities for teens and young adults who show passion for music and demonstrate talent to record their work. This experience has been known to better one's self-esteem and often leads to development of skills in business and self-management. We have special programs for at-risk youth, as well as the mentally and physically challenged. When ready after a 10-week series, we record our students and give them a CD to show the fruit of their efforts. This experience leads to self-confidence. Visit us at www.starjasminemusic.org. Star Jasmine Music, sharing music exploration through teaching and recording.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara.
And John, so we were talking before the break about, you know, the entrepreneur that started it versus the VC and kind of how that shook out. So when an entrepreneur or a business starts and you do the initial round of capital to them, how often are they looking for a follow-on or needing more money, and how often do you get involved in that?
Every time. I mean, most companies are designed to take in money, grow the value of the company with that money, so increase their revenue, build infrastructure, hire people, but with the knowledge they're going to go out and raise more money. Now, what we always look for is a path to profitability. We don't drive our companies to profitability, but we always want, and this is what you asked the question about kind of founder. I love founders that have that in mind. Like, they're frugal. They value the a dollar, and they're always sort of looking for that exit. Like, okay, if the market turns on me, how can I keep this business running without having to get more money from people like John?
Right.
You know, how can I get more money from my customers? Now, that's often, you're not going to grow as fast if you're bootstrapping like that. But if you have no plan to be able to bootstrap, then I probably don't want to invest in your company. And you're probably not the kind of founder that I would want to invest in.
Now, when you look at founders, are you looking at age? Like, do you prefer a young, hungry 20-year-old?
That sounds illegal. I'm not sure.
Yeah, all right, then don't answer.
No, I don't look at those kind of things.
Or do you look for experience versus tenacity, and, you know, what are those key factors that really are an aha moment? Like, this is somebody that I want to take to that next level.
Right. It's not, I mean, I'm just joking about that. It's not age per se, but what I do look at is serial experience. So, and there's different investors, and I'm so happy that we have a spectrum. Some investors really want to invest in a first-time founder. They want to invest in somebody that's, you know, learning this all for the first time. I've done that, and I've done it a lot. But I think I need to balance that, because those investments tend to take more of my time with people that have done it before. So people that have had one or two, maybe even three successes in the past, they really know how to do it. They still want some guidance and help, but they're just going to need less of that from somebody like me. So if I'm building my portfolio appropriately, I'm going to have a little bit of both in my portfolio.
But if you talk about scaling, you've been talking about it as if you're the only employee in this company, maybe your partner. Is there another way to scale up by hiring, you know, some Harvard MBAs, or does that doesn't work? I mean, why can't you have 50 people working for you who are to be mentors? I mean, I'm joking, but you know.
You know, what is that old adage that if you want to invite a problem, hire a person?
No, but I mean, the leverage could be, this is naive in a way, but leverage can also be by increasing your own production capability. Is that not possible because it's such a personal business?
I suppose it's possible. Our fund structure, I mean, our fund is small by design, and there's just not a lot of money to hire people. So we have one assistant, basically, that really works with my partner more than she does me. So even 2% of a fund our size is just not that much money to pay people. Now, there are other funds that have a different model. They'll raise $100 million, $250 million, $300 million, and I've been to their offices many
times. Well, Blackstone or, you know, Apollo.
Yeah, they're hiring, and they have all kinds of layers of employees and staff that'll vet deals and source deals. It's just a different model. That's how they scale. But for the model, we have two people doing about 2 to 3 deals each a year. It works fine.
And so how much early stage capital have you given out to the Santa Barbara community?
Oh, to Santa Barbara. So we've only done 3 deals here. We did local market launch, one that did not succeed. So that was one that it was really, they're all painful when they don't work out.
Well, it's like your baby.
Yeah. And you know, those people, I'm still very good friends with them. And it wasn't for lack of trying. That was one where, you know, everything's clear in retrospect. We had a chance to sell that company probably a couple times, and it wasn't out of greed that we didn't. It just, you know, I look back on it, and we probably just should have pursued those exits more aggressively. And then I've been involved in Invoca from the beginning, which was called Ring Revenue back in the day. And I don't remember how much we have in that one, but I'd say collectively between HD Data and Invoca, I don't know, 5 million or something like that.
And so would you say that your geographical, do you have any geographical boundaries?
So if you're early stage, I think you have to be close to your businesses if you're really going to service them and be there when they need you. So we started out LA only, LA Santa Barbara, and we were really concentrated in Santa Monica for a period there. We had a lot of companies in Santa Monica. My partner decided he wanted to spend more time up north, which was great. And then I ended up spending more time in San Diego. So I have some businesses down there. I've gotten somewhat involved in that. I'm pretty well networked down there. I'm not quite like Santa Barbara by any means, but it's a wonderful community, very welcoming of new people. And so that's been kind of easy to get to know people in. So our geography now is San Diego to San Francisco, essentially.
So California,
yes, California
in general.
Yeah. Surf Air. I'll give Surf Air a plug.
Right.
Surf Air has been wonderful.
Where Surf Air goes, you will
right,
too.
right. And I love Arnoldi's, by the way, as well, the sponsor.
Yes, Arnoldi's.
Yes.
You know, did I tell you? We are in number one, as a side note, of the bocce ball tournament Monday nights.
Oh, really? Nice.
We're in the finals next week. So I just want
is
to point that out.
Is there any way that, like in soccer, you could go public with your team?
Yeah, I don't think so.
No, that's not going to...
Have you ever played bocce? It's really...
Are you sponsored? Do you have like a bocce ball?
We're
like,
sponsored by Arlington. It's Arlington Financial Advisors.
You got to get like a bocce ball company to sponsor you, though.
Yeah, exactly. Wouldn't that be funny? I'm sorry, we have our own balls.
Yeah, right.
So, John, you've also done some angel investing, which you mentioned early on. Mm-hmm. What would you... explain to our listeners what the major differences are behind angel investing and venture capital?
So an angel investor is typically someone that's writing checks for their own checkbook, and they don't do it for a living. They have some other vocation, or they're just retired, and it's not, they're not making they're not paying their mortgage with their investments. And there's kind of it's a spectrum, right? So there's people that are called super angels, and they kind of act as a VC fund, and maybe they have $20 million that they put to work, but it's still primarily their money. That's the main difference. They typically, angels just, you know, by their nature are going to write smaller checks and get in earlier. I really love the angel community because I work really closely with them. They're a good source of, you know, we talked about referrals. They're a good source of referrals for me, where they put money in at, you know, when it was an idea, they help get the founder to the point where they have real revenue, and then it's appropriate for an institutional investor to put money in.
So do you usually wait until, because you're such an early stage venture capital fund, do you get them on a path of profitability, you had mentioned, but do they need to show some revenue before you invest normally?
I always laugh that we say we're an early VC investor. We are. But it's kind of funny, like in the entrepreneur's eyes, it's just not early at all. Like, well, wait a minute, I have revenue.
It's like, this is a teenager, people.
Right.
This is not an infant.
I've been doing this for a while, right? So it's early with regard to the industry. It's not necessarily early in the minds of the entrepreneurs.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KCSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to mom, but a little over a year ago, we realized she couldn't take care of herself without our help. And well, how could I not be there for her? I had no idea how hard it would be and just what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and, even for me, ways to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics that got me started, but also information about the hurdles I was facing in this new role. I could even connect with experts and hear from others who had been in my place. I know this road we're on isn't an easy one, but I'm really happy to have the extra help for her and for me.
Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. This message is brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk. brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And we're in studio with John Greathouse, serial entrepreneur and professor in the technology management program at UCSB.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about that program. It is unique and special within the UCSB community.
It is, and it grew. I think one reason it's worked so well is it grew organically from one class. So there were some students that really, this is in the late 90s, said, you know, we want to know a little bit about business. They were engineers before we, you know, walk out into the world. So it started out as one class, and then it was kind of a skunk's work project where we kind of kept it quiet and didn't want interference from other people at the university. And anyway, grew over time, and now it's a full-fledged program. It's one of the most popular programs on campus. And I think it's because we're providing students with just life skills. These are skills, whether they want to be an entrepreneur or a business person or not, they can still take the skills in those classes that we provide and take them out into the workforce. So I think it's a wonderful, I mean, obviously, I've been there 10 years.
Oh, my goodness, it's been 10 years.
I know. It's grown
quite.
In
full disclosure, I did speak at one of your classes.
Yes.
Never invited back.
Never invited back. I don't repeat speakers.
Well,
you want
to know
that.
Why? I transferred you to the person who actually knew about nonprofit management.
No, she was good too, but I never had, I don't repeat speakers. So
interesting.
A little secret is, it's not much of a secret. What I found is, If somebody comes once, they nail it, they kill it, you did a great job. Repeat offenders typically phone it in. They're like, oh, I've done it, I can just deny the walk-in.
Oh.
I did it a couple times with people, and I thought, you know, and plus it's just, it's more fun for me to have
New people, and then you learn something as well.
People just get more fired up. But now my Innovator Stories program, which is filmed, four-camera professional film by UCTV, has gotten quite popular. Very proud of what we've been able to do with that program. And it's become a nice sort of calling card for the university. A lot of people all over the world watch it and listen to it on podcasts.
Is that why you're wearing makeup today?
I had my hair done special for this, and I'm kind of pissed. But I am impressed. I got to say that you have Mark Knopfler playing live in studio every time we come back. What do you have to pay him to do that?
You know, he does it out of the goodness of his heart.
Wow. I'm going to talk to him afterwards and ask him for some stories.
And so how did you get involved in teaching out at the university?
So so I was kind of taking time off from my various exploits, and I was in, year one or two of a hiatus. And my commitment was I'll teach one class one time, and then 10 years later I'm still there and teaching a bunch of classes and really enjoying it. But I just kind of put my toe in the water and ended up, you know, really, really getting – great energy from the students.
Well, I'm sure it must feed your soul, that energy and excitement.
It does.
So out of your classes, how many would you say go on to create their next entrepreneur venture?
Entrepreneurs typically in societies, including ours, it's 2-3% of the population are true entrepreneurs. But I think I define it a little bit more broadly. It's people that, you know, join a startup or join a small company, defined as a company with less than 50 people. There's a fair number of those students. So I think we give them a little bit of courage to don't be afraid, you know, of a company that just because they're not monolithic and huge and your parents think you should go there because they've heard of it.
Right.
I think we've done a good job of encouraging students to maybe take chances on smaller companies that they might have been a bit more reticent to do. And a bunch do have started coming. We have IPOs, we have public companies, we have all kinds of success stories.
That's great.
Yep.
This has been very, very interesting. John, I think I'm going to start a company so we can have a better relationship. I can have coffee.
I get $12 on me. I'll front you.
Thanks so much for being with us.
That's fun,
John.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, John Greathouse. And you've been listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll see you next week.
It's